Numbers 13 from verse 26. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here are its fruit. But the people who live there are very powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the lands, for we can certainly do it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack those people. They're stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they'd explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." That night, all the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, "If only we'd died in Egypt, or in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." This is the word of the Lord.
Wonderful. If you can keep your Bibles open at Numbers 13 and 14, that would be great. Thank you. And we're continuing our series in Numbers that we've been working through for a few weeks now. And I'm pleased to say that this passage is slightly more straightforward than some of the others we've had in recent weeks. And hopefully it'll make some sense to you as I preach to you from it. It certainly made good sense to me as I was preparing it, but I don't know whether that's a good sign or not, really. What we do have, though, however, is we've got the middle of the story, and what we don't have is the beginning and the end of the story here. So what I will do is I'll give you a little recap of what's gone before this, has led us up to this passage, and then I will, at the end, we'll talk about what follows as well, and God's response to the people following this passage. So essentially what's gone on before this, you remember just a couple of weeks ago we were about to set out from Mount Sinai, and then we had the whole quail incident last week. And now the Israelites are on the very edge of the Promised Land. They've got to the place they're going to, and they're about to go in. But before they go in, God says to Moses, "Send out 12 spies or scouts into the land, scout out the area, see what it's like. Send one from each tribe." And that's what Moses does. He sends out a scout, one from each tribe. And they go out into the land and they look and see what they can find. And then what we read here is what happens when those scouts or spies return. And what do you think they found? Well, we heard what they found. But actually, it should be no surprise to us what they found, and it should certainly have been no surprise to the Israelites what they found either. Because what they found in the land when they went looking was exactly what God said they would find when they go looking. What they found in the land was exactly what God said they would find. They found a land flowing with milk and honey, a land that was fertile, a land that was good. And they also found some people there. And they're the people God told them they would find. So it's no surprise that they're the people who are there. And so you'd think that if they found what they're expecting to find, what God had told them they were going to find, then really there's nothing to talk about, is there? Yes, it's exactly as we expected. Let's press on with the mission. But there's a little bit of a disagreement between the scouts, and there's a 10-2 split on what should be done. Whether the people should go into the land, do as God has commanded them, force out the people who are there and take possession of it, or whether they should not do that. That's the decision that's before them. At this point, you might be thinking, what about those poor people who are in the land anyway? Surely it's not fair on them. They're just there going about their own business quite happily. And all of a sudden, this people of God, and they get forced out of their own land because the people of God want to live there, or God wants his people to live there now. That's not really fair, is it? It's not really on these people. But actually, what we need to know about these people is that they were people who were not doing as they should. And the Israelites coming to live in the land is as much a judgment on the people who are living in the land as it is a blessing for the people of Israel themselves. And we know that because back in Genesis chapter 15, when God talks to Abraham about the land all those years ago, he talks about the people who are in the land already. And he says, in 400 years' time, your descendants are going to be strangers, going to be living in a strange land for 400 years. But when they eventually go into the land, they'll take possession of this land that's theirs. But it's not time yet, because the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. You see, the people in the land, they are not doing as God wants. In fact, actually, their sin is so great before God that it's an aberration to him. So actually, it's not quite like they're happily going about their business, normal people who are about to be forced out of their own land. It's more like, imagine you have a house and the house is empty and someone moves into that house who doesn't belong there. You haven't invited them. They've just come off their own back. You've got a squatter. But they don't take care of your house. In fact, no, they're damaging the property. They're painting up the walls. They're tearing up the carpets. They're destroying your house. And so you go through the appropriate channels to try and get them removed. You send them letters. You get court judgments. And none of that works. So eventually you send round the bailiffs to turf them out. And that's what happens. But just imagine someone was walking past your house on that day and all they saw was bailiffs manhandling a person out of your flat. They may think that actually something untoward's going on, something not quite fair is going on, but they don't know the backstory. So actually, God has a right and has a duty to judge the people who are living in a land, because actually they're living in a way which is abhorrent to him. And we don't know exactly what the sin of the Amorites was, but quite possibly, judging by some of the things we read in the Old Testament, it was things that we would find offensive and unpalatable ourselves. So here they are on the edge of the Promised Land, about to go in. And the scouts bring back a split report. Well, in fact, they don't bring back a split report. All the scouts agree. They agree on what is to be found in the land, how good the land is, but they also agree that there are these people in the land. People who look to our earthly eyes quite big, strong, and scary. And that's why 10 of the scouts have come to the conclusion that they should not enter the land because it is too dangerous. And just 2 of the scouts have the conclusion that they should enter the land because God is with them. So verses 27 to 29 and 31 to 33 is the report of those 10. And they say that there are these big, scary people in the land. More than that, there are the Nephilim in the land. Now, those of you who've read through Genesis will know that the Nephilim were characters who pop up there. They're quite obscure. We don't really know who they are or what they're about. But Genesis seems to suggest that they are the children of angels and women. That the angels who fell from heaven came down to earth, saw that women were quite attractive, and had children with them. And these children were sort of like half angel, half people, and they were big and strong. They were like great warriors. Now, when we get to this point in Israel, it's quite possible that kind of the Nephilim have reached this kind of mythical status in their minds. It was almost like, here be giants. There are giants in those countries. Don't go there. They're massive. They will destroy us. But Caleb, in verse 30 there, he speaks out. See, he has faith in God. He doesn't deny the situation that the other scouts have outlined, but he remembers what God has done, and he knows that God is with them, and he knows that God will do as he has promised. And these two conflicting opinions of what should be done come before the people. And would you believe it? But the people of God, they're back to their old tricks. And actually, so if we look at verses 1 to 4, some of these words are very familiar. And certainly the sentiment that we see there is very familiar from other passages we've heard in Numbers. So all night the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole assembly said to them, "If only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. As if when they returned in Egypt, they'd be welcomed with open arms. You see, the people of God are back to their old tricks. See, what they should be doing is remembering. To remember is the very heart of what Judaism was all about. Remember, remember, remember what God has done for you. But they have forgotten. And they've forgotten a lot of things. They have not only forgotten what God has done and what God has continued to do for them, but they've also forgotten the situation they were in Egypt. They are looking back with very, very rose-coloured glasses onto a life which was much worse, but in their minds they have painted to be so much better. You see, God's word should have been enough for them. When God said, "Enter the land, I will be with you, I will fight for you, and I will drive out the peoples ahead of you," they should have believed him. And even if that wasn't enough, then what God has already done for them, the things that he has done for them, the way he has provided for them, protected them, and cared for them, should have been enough for them to know that God could be trusted. And even if that wasn't enough, the fact that they had God living in the midst of them, God was there with them at that very moment, and visible signs of his presence with them were there for all to see, should have been enough. They had his words, they had his deeds, and they had his presence. But even with all that evidence of God's love for them, and God's care for them, and God's plan for them, and God's provision for them, they found reasons not to trust him. I want to suggest it's not the problem. The problem of these people is not that they're faithless, but it's the problem is that they put their faith in the wrong places. You see, they should have placed their faith solely in God, but they have placed their faith instead in themselves. And what those scouts did, and in turn what the people did when they heard the report, is they saw the people that were in the land and they measured themselves against those people. And when they did that, they realized that they were smaller than the people in the land, they were fewer than the people in the land, and they were weaker than the people in the land. And so their conclusion was, "We cannot enter this land." What they should have done was compare the people in the land to God. And then they would have realized that no matter how big they seem in our eyes, to God's eyes, they are nothing. In fact, Caleb says the same. He says, all their defenses have been stripped away. They cannot stand against God. Why are we afraid? But they've put faith in themselves, and they found themselves wanting. Seems that human beings, we're hardwired to doubt. As I was preparing this, I got into a bit of a YouTube loop. I don't know if you do this, but as you're kind of looking at things on YouTube and kind of researching things, and you click on the next video, and it leads you down a rabbit hole. And as I was kind of looking at a few things on YouTube kind of around this as I was doing a bit of prep, a video popped up in the suggested videos, and it was one of those debates between the kind of new atheist movements and Christians, and kind of got then onto a whole load of videos, which are really interesting to look at, actually, and see the arguments that come for both sides. But it got me thinking about this new atheist movement. And I wonder if we could get Richard Dawkins in the room, we could ask him the question, what would it take to prove to you that there was a God? I wonder if he would answer that question for first, but I wonder what he would say. But you know what I reckon? I reckon there is nothing that would prove to him that there was a God. Because even if God wrote in letters in the sky, I am real, Jesus is my name. Or even if he were to meet God face to face, the human mind has an amazing way of finding reasons not to believe. In essence, what is it more difficult to believe? That God has always been, he's created this world and he wants a relationship with us. Or that all this, everything we see, everything we're part of and ourselves even, came from nothing. Well, they're both impossible to believe, really. And yet they'll happily accept one but not another. It seems that human beings are hardwired to find reasons not to trust God and not to believe in God. And we know that's true ourselves, don't we? Because we have moments, even though we have faith, we have moments when we doubt. And with all the good things God has done for us, all the wonderful gifts he has given to us, and if we were to look back and remember, they would probably be too numerous to count. Yet we still find many, many reasons to doubt. Let me tell you a little story. It's a true story. It happened to me. That's how I know it's true. But I'm not sure of the truth that I'm going to tell you anymore. Because it happened to me a while ago. It was when I was 18. I had a girlfriend at the time who wasn't Amy. That would have been weird because she'd have been 8. But anyway, that's another story. I was 18 and I had a girlfriend who lived in a village that was close by. And there were some backcountry roads that led to her house from my house. And so one night I was driving over there and I saw something that stopped me in my tracks. What I saw was a cat. It wasn't just any cat, though. It wasn't the kind of cat I had sat on my bed at home. It was the kind of cat you see in a zoo. It's a big cat. It was black. It was about the size of an Alsatian. And it was just sat by the side of the road looking at me as I drove towards it. And I stopped, and I looked, and I stared, and it looked back at me, and then it ran off into the undergrowth, never to be seen again. Just a few seconds, but I saw it with my own eyes. Now, if you ask me today whether I believe there are big cats at large in the UK, my answer to you is, I'm not sure. Now, you may say, well, that's ridiculous. You saw it with your own eyes. But the truth is, I doubt myself. I wonder whether it was just one of those nights. Maybe I was a bit tired. Maybe it was just a small cat that kind of got blown up in the headlights. Maybe it was an Alsatian and I just was a bit tired. I don't know. I'd say I'm 50-50, to be honest. But I'm not sure. I know I felt sure in that moment, but I'm not sure now. And it just shows us how easy it is for us to forget and to doubt ourselves. And if we can doubt ourselves in that way, how much easier is it to doubt in a God? A God who we talk about a lot, But actually, we don't see. Although we see signs of him everywhere, it's easy just to begin to doubt and lose faith. And what's more, even if we don't doubt that God is real, perhaps we do doubt that God really cares about us, about me, about my life. Perhaps it's easy to believe that God is doing things in other people's lives and wants other people to do things. He's got plans for them, but for me, maybe he doesn't have plans. Why would he care about me? And I wonder if you ever ask that question. It's one I ask quite often. That question of God, where you say, God, please, please, just give me a little bit more to go on. Just give me another small reason why I can believe in you. Just give me a little sign of your presence. Or just do something in this area of my life. Just do that little thing for me and then I'll know and then I'll be wholehearted towards you. But the truth is, it doesn't matter what God does. The doubt still remains. Actually, everything is not enough for us. There's still that question. It was there at the heart of the Israelites, and it's there in our heart too. See, God had a plan for the Israelites. He wanted them to go into the land. And if they'd done that, they would have had an amazing time seeing what God was doing before them. And they'd have settled in that wonderful place where God wanted them to be. And they've had that relationship of God's people living with God in the land that he had created or set aside for them. But actually, they missed out on that. See, the way the story ends is this. The people all decide that they're not going to go into the land. That they'd rather stay in the desert. It's too dangerous. And God gets angry. God gets angry because he's told them to go and they won't go. He's told them he would be with them and they don't believe him. They don't trust him. They lack faith. But you'll find if you read on in that story that actually God forgives them. And even as Moses is pleading for the people, asking God to forgive them, God says, I've already forgiven them. They're already forgiven. God forgives his people. And what's more, he doesn't abandon his people. He does judge them. They do face his judgment. In fact, the judgment they face is that they will never set foot in that promised land. The whole generation, save for the two who said they should go, the whole generation never get to set foot in the promised land. They die in the wilderness. Even Moses, although for a slightly different reason. They never get to set foot in the promised land that God had for them. They never get to see the blessing that God had for them. It's their children who go into the promised land who see that. But God does not abandon them. He stays with them. God stays with his people in the desert all those long years. He goes with them where they go. He forgives them and he stays with them, although they do miss out on his blessing. God didn't abandon his people because of their unbelief, but they do miss out on something amazing, and it's the same for us. See, we do have doubts. It's very natural, it's very human, and it's okay. But the truth is, do we let those doubts have control over us, or do we put our faith in God despite the doubts? Often I have a sense when I'm kind of praying, particularly when I'm praying for what the next step is, or when I don't know which way to go, or I don't know what is ahead in the road. And I have a sense, perhaps one way which is an easy way, a safe way, or another way which is a tough decision, going to cost me something. And in those moments, I often just hear a very quiet voice, not in my ears, but somewhere in my heart. And it's God just whispering. He says, which way are you going to go? You can take the easy road, that's fine. You can, I'll still be with you. You'll still have that relationship with me. You'll still be a Christian. You won't lose your faith. But actually, if you take this road, if you face the difficulties, if you take a step of faith, I've got something amazing I can show you. If you go the easy way, you'll never see it. But if you come this way, you can see something amazing. I've got something amazing in store. And I must admit that at times when I've heard that small voice, I've taken the easy choice. And I know I've missed out on something good. And there are times when I've decided to take that risk. And God's been true to his word. God will never abandon us. No matter what we do. Because actually the story of Christianity is one of God who goes seeking after his people. Who goes searching for each and every one of us. And he'll never let us go. He will never abandon us. But actually he's got some amazing things in plan, in store. For each and every one of us. He has amazing things ahead. And we can go on that journey with God if we have the courage and if we have the faith. All you've got to do is want it. All you've got to do is choose it. It's not easy, but it will be amazing if we're able to take that stand and go with him.